They didn't give you an external mic. Okay, so today is the 7th of May, and I am at Circle District Historical Society Museum. This is Laurel Tyrell. I'm here with Alfred Cook, and he has agreed to talk about his knowledge of Central Circle Hot Springs. Al, before we get talking about your background in Central, could you just tell me where you were born and you grew up?
Okay. Yeah, I was born in San Diego, California. Lived in Long Beach, California until I was 8 years old, and then moved to Northern Illinois, the little town of Shanahan, where I lived until I was 17 and a half, almost 18. Then I went off to college at Blackburn College in Carlinville, Illinois.
And what kind of a degree did you come out with?
And I came out with a BA, majored in chemistry from Blackburn, and then went on to Southern Illinois University down in Carbondale, where I again was majoring in chemistry and received the Master of Science degree. And later on after that, I went back to school in California. I moved back to California and got my BSCE from California State University, Los Angeles, and then went on to the University of Iowa in Iowa City and got my master's degree in civil engineering there.
Okay. So when did you end up coming to Central?
Well, my currently my mining partner at the time at Southern Illinois University, he was a roommate, and he transferred down to the University of Louisiana and was getting his degree in his master's degree in geography, and he called me up one spring and said that one of our friends had gotten a pickup truck and would I like to go to Alaska, and of course that was a silly question, so a couple months later we started out, and we drove up the Alcan Highway and got into the state on the 2nd of July in 1969. It had been a very warm summer. In fact, I think one of the record highs in Fairbanks occurred that summer in June. And as soon as we got into the state, it began to rain, and it rained most of the summer. We went down to south of Delta Junction near Donnelly Dome, and we looked around there, and then we came up to Fairbanks and decided, since this was a mining area out here, to drive out. And we drove out, we stayed at the Chattanooga campground, and then we drove along and we got to about 101 mile near Eagle Creek, and we saw the sign, and it said something like, I think, pan for gold, $5. So naturally we drove in and we met a miner. His name was Dick Simmons, and with him he had his little son Ricky, and Ricky took us down to go panning, and down we went, and sure enough one of us got a little flake of gold, and of course we were at that time quite thrilled. And we drove on and pulled into Central and Lodge and met Roy Riddle. And Roy had just opened the new lodge, I believe, on Memorial Day. And we were getting to the point now, by this time it was after the 4th of July. And Roy was already talking about selling the lodge. So when we talked a while with him, we buzzed right by Brian Frank's place. It didn't look too appealing, so we continued on to Circle City, the big gold mining town, and drove in there, spent the night at the campground, and we met a couple of bow hunters. They were going bear hunting, and they wanted somebody to go in with them, somebody with a four-wheel drive pickup. They also had a four-wheel drive pickup, I believe. And they said, we know where you can pan for gold. Well, that got us. And we spent the next night at the Circle Hot Springs Airport. And the following day, we drove out on what is now called the Portage Creek Road. We had always, or up until the time the sign went on it, we'd always referred to as Bottom Dollar Road. Dell and Henry Choate used to refer to it as the road to Bottom Dollar. So we drove out and drove as far as we could, which is about 9.5 miles beyond the Hot Springs Airport. This is ground that we have since filed a mining claim on and patented the ground. And we met a man named Joe Lietza and his, I believe his nephew or cousin, young man named Cliff Milanowski. And they told us pretty much where to go panning, which was down where the road crosses Bottom Dollar Creek. And I shouldn't really say the road crosses Bottom Dollar Creek. The road went right to Bottom Dollar Creek, and there was a bedrock exposure there. And then it rose abruptly about 4 feet. So at that time, you didn't go beyond Bottom Dollar. Previously, there had been a trail all the way at least down to Harrison Creek. So we panned happily away, and they told us that, that is Joe and Cliff, that we could come up and put our tent up on the hillside where the road makes a bend. So we put up the tent, and I can remember one thing there. My partner Dan was warming up some soup, and by the time he got done warming up the soup, it was probably about 10 to 15% mosquitoes. And the people we met, two miners, were in a fix. They had been left out there. Their one partner had gone into town with the first of the gold that they had mined, and he hadn't come back. And they had very little food and no transportation. So quite naturally, we had food, we had transportation. So a five-way mining partnership developed for the summer. And I can remember we spent probably 20 days mining, and it was cold, it was rainy, it was windy, and that didn't seem to bother the mosquitoes at all. And they had this fantastic triple sluice suction dredge from Keen Engineering with a couple of Tecumseh engines on it, which had, after the first week, pulled loose from the mountings, and they had those strapped on. And they had a pond that had been pushed up for them by the partner who went into town. He had a bulldozer, small one, so he pushed up a dam for them, and they were happily using the suction dredge and getting a little bit of gold. And in 20 days we worked for them, I believe we got about just a little bit over 5 ounces, which was an ounce apiece, which was at $35 an ounce would have been $35 a piece for us. We each got the ounce. But unfortunately, it was only about 3/4 gold, so actually the value goes down a bit. We made about $1.50 a day standing around in the cold water. Well, naturally, this gave us the gold bug really bad, and we're still here 40 years later.
Mining in the same place.
Mining in the same place. We patented that ground. Actually, I'm mining about 3/4 of a mile upstream, and in a good week, I'll get as much gold as all five of us did for the 20 days.
And have the mosquitoes changed?
The mosquitoes have changed considerably. The mosquitoes, I can remember being bad up here up until around 1980. They have dropped off considerably since then. And if you read in the history, they talk about looking out on the flats and seeing black clouds of mosquitoes. Even in the bad days, we didn't see that, although I can remember being on a hike back from Squaw Creek one time, three of us hiking back, I believe this was 1973, although it might have been 75. The wind was blowing a gale, and each person had to be careful so they didn't step into the cloud of mosquitoes, which was downwind from the other person. That, like I say, that was in the early to mid-70s. Since then, they have dropped.
Well, let's move to Central's historical past. What can you tell me about the research that you've done? As I know you did some research with Pat Oakes, and then as chairperson of the Circle District Historical Society, into Central's past.
Well, basically, I've gathered information here, there, and everywhere, and of course, fortunately, didn't write down any of the sources. But basically, it boils down to trio of three Native Americans, part Russian, part Athabascan, Pitka Pavlov, Cherosky Demosky, and then Irenia Pavlov, the brother of Pitka. And these...
Irenia is a brother?
I'm sorry, sister of Pitka. And these two, Irenia and Pitka, were siblings of John Minook. And John Minook was the discoverer of gold at Rampart. It was a creek named after him, Minook Creek. They were on a hunting trip, and they were on Birch Creek. Location is not really known for sure. And they did some panning, and they found good prospects on a bar. And this was in 1892. Being Native Americans, they were in a different time system than, let's say, the white man, so they had things they had to do when it concerned the natural things of fishing, hunting, and everything. And so they didn't plan on coming right back. They figured they'd get up an outfit and come back the following year, from what I can gather. Unfortunately, Cherusky went partying 40 Mile, and he managed to spill the beans, and a bunch of white men who were also partying at 40 Mile picked up those beans, and when they attempted to come back the following year, they were followed. And they showed the white men the location where they had found the gold. So if you read the Sam Dunham report to the Department of Labor dated about 1899, he reveals that they rediscovered gold. And I think I gave you the names previously. The one I remember is Henry Lewis. The other name I seem to have managed to forget. Anyway, in the Donham Report, they gave a date for the discovery of gold by the white men in the same spot. And, of course, I think Donham had his tongue in his cheek right then because he mentioned that the Indians had found it there the previous year. So much for discoveries.
Right, I have Gus Williams, John McLeod, and Henry Lewis as reported in the Sam Dunham Report of 1893. Is that the same report?
Okay, so I think the Dunham Report was dated 99.
Well, we can look that up.
The date that he gave a date, I believe, in August or something like that of 1893 when the white man's discovery was made.
Okay.
Well, they looked this over, and the following winter, a whole group of people wintered at an area that they call Old Portage, and I think it's 12 to 14 miles upriver from Circle City. It's at about a point where maybe one of the earliest points where it would be easy to cross over from the Yukon River to Birch Creek. I'm not sure if that's near the Tacoma Bluffs or not. I'd have to look at a map for that. Maybe we'll walk in and look at a map in a few minutes. But they spent the winter at Old Portage, and they decided this was not a great place for a town because the next spring the area that they stayed at flooded out. Anyway, they set out to do prospecting, and they got onto Birch Creek, and I believe probably split up into parties. And I don't know who Mr. Harrison was, but one group went up Harrison Creek, another group went up a fork called Coulomb's Fork, which is a great name for being misspelled because it is probably spelled as the scientific name Coulomb, probably pronounced Columba. The guy, it was named after there were two or three brothers, the Coulomb brothers. Anyway, this ends up being called Plum's Fork, Columbus Fork, Plum's Fork. I looked at the records in just one book, and I believe it was from 1910 to 1916, and counted almost 20 different spellings of it on one of the USGS maps that's current, maybe the smaller quadrangle map. It's called Plum's Fork, and yet on the bigger map, it's called Coulomb's Fork. Anyway, this was one of the forks. One of the other people who probably led one of the groups was George Harrington, and this is Harrington's Fork. Originally, from what I can gather, the discovery was near the break between the South Fork and the North Fork of Birch Creek. The South Fork is still listed as South Fork. The rest of the creek is now pretty much considered Birch Creek, but I believe that was the North Fork. This caused considerable confusion with the USGS because in one of their reports, they reported that Pitka's Bar was at the intersection of the North Fork and South Fork of Harrison Creek, which actually, from the way the claims were filed and everything, would be absolutely impossible because there were supposedly on Pitka's Bar, I think at least six, maybe eight claims on the bar. So this is a long bar. Today, it's considered to be the bar that's at the intersection of Harrison Creek and Birch Creek. And the map drawn by V.Z. Wilson in 1894, a map, which, by the way, I think he managed to get the information in a bar and circle. It's located nearer to the South Fork, and I believe it's actually downstream from the South Fork. Anyway, parties went out, and in 1894 they had named Squaw Creek. Independence Creek had a name. Mastodon Creek had a name. I believe Mammoth had been named. There was one called Malamute, which was an attempt to spell Malamute. And this was, I believe, from what I can see from the map, the South Fork of Harrison Creek. So there's an indication that they actually followed the gold, quite possibly up Harrison Creek to Mastodon Dome, and then came down the other side. It's hard to tell on this because of the, but it looks like the creeks were, may have been named from the upstream downward. So that you'll find that Crooked Creek turns into Porcupine and Mammoth Creek, and Mammoth Creek breaks into Mastodon Creek and Independence Creek, rather than retaining the name Mammoth Creek up one of the two. And I take this as an indication that they were named coming down. They gave a creek the name Independence. Somebody else came down one of the other creeks, called it Mammoth Creek. When those two creeks came together, rather than keeping either of the two names, they renamed the creek Mammoth. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened then when they came into Porcupine. They changed the name from, and didn't keep either Mammoth or Porcupine. They called it Crooked Creek. You'll find in the literature that it was said they did this because you were only allowed to have one claim on a creek. And therefore, by keeping or changing the names, you could have more than one claim. The main problem with that theory is that no one who had a claim on Mastodon Creek had a claim on Independence Creek. And furthermore, only one person, as far as I can remember from my research, had a claim on more than one creek in the district in the early days. This would be Eric Herman. Eric Herman and John Fee, I believe it was, were the discoveries of Deadwood Creek. So Herman had a claim on Deadwood Creek, and I believe he also had a claim, and I'm not sure if it was Eagle Creek or not. That doesn't seem quite right because it was discovered after Deadwood. But if you look at the names of the people who are discoverers of claims on Deadwood Creek, none of them were on Mastodon, none of them were on Independence. And in fact, Independence only had, I believe, three claimants the first year. So that kind of ends the theory that people did it so they could have a large number of claims. You could have a large number of claims in the district, but you had to buy them from somebody else. Anyway, so that brings us down then to 1894. In July, and I think it was the 22nd of July, they formed what they call Birch Creek Mining District Number 1, Mastodon Creek. And a couple weeks later, they formed Birch Creek Mining District Number 2, Independence Creek, and they wrote up their rules and regulations. And by the time it came time to do Birch Creek Mining District Number 3, nobody knows what that was. It's a possibility it was Squaw Creek. It could have been Deadwood Creek, which was discovered in the fall. There were some shenanigans on Deadwood Creek, so it also became known as Hogham Creek because somebody tried to hog all the claims. Interesting indication that whoever did that might have been the recorder. They gave him a rather hard time, invalidated a lot of the claims, and didn't really start measuring the claims out until the spring in April of 1895. It became pretty obvious with Mastodon Creek that there was gold here in paying quantities. Mm-hmm. And that meant that they had to get supplies out here. Jack McQuesten sent someone down, I think his last name was English. Barney Hill was also with McQuesten. And they, I believe, staked out the town site for Circle City and started constructing buildings. This man I spoke of who drew the map, V.C. Wilson, had come down. He was taking pictures of the mining in 40 Mile when he heard about the strike on Circle City. So he continued on down in a canoe, if I remember correctly. And he took some pictures of Circle City, and they're unusual. Most pictures of Circle City are taken from the steamship looking from the river on shore. His pictures were taken from beyond the town and shows the tents and everything that were staked out along the river. And as near as I can figure, he left Circle City in September, and he may have gone out on the first steamship that came in, or the first, riverboat that came in to Circle City that fall or late summer. Freighting was done out to the mines, and a lot of the freight was brought out in the wintertime. It was much less expensive to bring it out by sled. And they established a trail. They went out from Circle City to 8 Mile House, which is about where you hit Birch Creek, just north of the hills they go come over from Circle City. There's a trail past a big lake, and you skirt the hills on the north side and hit Birch Creek, and 8 Mile House should have been there. This was not a major place. They brought everything to the major place, which was called 12 Mile House. It was called that because it was 12 miles out from Circle City. And it's probably several miles north of where the road now crosses, the Seas Highway now crosses Birch Creek. Despite the fact that USGS indicates that Circle City was at the current road crossing, that 12 Mile House was at the current road crossing, this is incorrect. From 12 Mile House, they cut up a bit over, went up creek and cut up a bit over the hills and came down, and they hit Crooked Creek at a place where they established the second of the houses, of the three houses, and it was referred to as Central House. And the other one possibly is near where Miller House used to be, out near Mammoth Creek. Okay, this was the house where the supplies were brought for distribution out to the mines. So there were the three houses, according to Arthur Walden, who wrote a book, Dog Puncher on the Yukon. They would start out from 12 Mile House, they'd stop at Central House the first night out, and then the second night out they would make it to the last of the places, probably called Mammoth House. And then on the way back into Circle City, because they would a lot of times go all the way back to Circle City, they would skip one of the houses because they were going back unloaded. Mm-hmm. And either stop at Central House and then make the run all the way to Circle City, or go all the way to 12 Mile House and then go into Circle City the next day. Well, this is why Central House was established. And it was established at the point where the trail intersected with Crooked Creek. Date for establishment is questionable. It would be either the fall of 1894 or possibly the winter of 1894-1895, depending on when you want to do log construction. But certainly it was in at that time when Josiah Edward Spur and his compatriots, one of which was Harold Beach Goodrich, and another guy, I don't remember the name, his last name was Schrader. These three came out from USGS. They were Harvard graduates, class of 1893, and here it is, summer of 1896, and they're battling the mosquitoes. Conveniently, they managed to do all their work in one summer instead of spending the 2 years that they had originally planned, and I think the mosquitoes had a lot to do with this. But anyway, Mr. Spur wrote a large, almost a treatise in the USGS bulletins, and as a matter of fact, I believe Schrader and Goodrich also wrote in that. And by this time, Central House is shown. They mention Hoggum Junction, which was the other roadhouse in the area, which was on the line going from the jump-off roadhouse out to Deadwood Creek. So they mention that two people at the jump-off. This is the spot when you're going to Deadwood where you leave Birch Creek. And this was under construction. The jump-off roadhouse was under construction when Spur came through in, I believe it's July or August of 1896. So they stopped there. They, as a matter of fact, it was, I think, at Hoggum Roadhouse, they might have split up because Spur continued up Deadwood Creek, got up there, went across to Greenhorn Creek and spoke, I believe, with Mark Loper, and then went across and came, somehow caught Independence Creek and came down into the very rich area, and I believe they met up there. They did quite a bit of mapping of the whole area, and this is how you find that there was, on the map, there was a Porcupine House listed, a Mammoth House, the Hoggum Junction Roadhouse. In fact, there was even a picture in Spur's book of this. He wrote a book as well as his report. And, of course, Central House listed on there and 12 Mile House as well. So, basically, this is the purpose behind Central. Central is the location of the central of the houses that supplied the mines, and specifically the mines out at Mastodon and Mammoth Creek. The following year, they went over to Eagle Creek and did the staking at Eagle Creek. They staked the upper reaches of Harrison Creek, either in 1894 or 1895, when the Squaw Creek had been named by 94. Whether they staked it in 94 or 95, they don't know. The problem they ran into is that gold was found in the Klondike and a bunch of people packed up and left, and the last guy on the creek took the record books, and they didn't come back. The record books from Mastodon and Independence and Deadwood and Eagle are still in existence and were at the recorder's office in Fairbanks up until about 3 years ago. So we don't know the exact dates on some of the creeks.
So you would say that it was established because of the mining activities. How have, in the 40 years you've been here, the mining activities affected the town of Central itself?
Well, about like mining activities used to affect Fairbanks, boom and bust. When we came in, gold was at $35 an ounce, and there were some people messing around on the creeks. We are getting into the era when the Keene dredges, the lightweight aluminum dredges, were beginning to be produced. And so there was some dredging activity and things like that. The creeks had been mined and were considered mined out because they mined as far as it was worth mining. When we came in 1969, the gold price was still down. It was set free, I believe, in 71. And I can remember, and I'm not sure if it was 71 when the price hit $150 an ounce or not, but we staked, or I staked mining claim, one of the ones that we patented in 1971, and we staked a few more claims in 1973. And there was beginning to be some activity because Lauren and Larry Hype were mining by, I think they came in 74, and they were mining downstream on Bottom Dollar near the intersection with Harrison Creek. They were brought in by a man named, I believe by a man named Ed McGriff. McGriff came in on a motorcycle of all things and went down Bottom Dollar Creek staking everything that hadn't been staked. I should mention that one of the residents of our area, Harold Going, had come in with a family, Terry and Sue Walston and their children, and I believe Sue's sister and her husband. And they staked some ground downstream on Bottom Dollar from us, and as a matter of fact, they staked in 1973, the same year we were staking. I believe that it was that fall or the following spring that Ed McGriff came in, and he staked all the way to the mouth of Harrison Creek and down Harrison Creek a certain distance, and also up Harrison Creek a certain distance. A lot of those claims are still in existence. They've been purchased by, I believe Rod Mitchell has one of the claims, and a guy named Lyle College, I believe, has claims down there. These were some that McGriff had staked. He brought in Ray Wolf, who's, up until he died a couple years ago, spent 20 to 30 years trying to unload his claims on somebody with little or no success. The problem with the claims on Harrison Creek was the fact that there wasn't much of the yellow metal available on them, from what I can gather. Mm-hmm. So that had increased. Okay, by 1973, there was interest showing up. This was because the price of gold had been allowed to float and had gone up, and I'm saying it went up to $150. It might have been $90 at that time. Whatever it was, it had gone up enough to encourage people because now some of the areas that were marginal were becoming feasible. Mm-hmm. Okay, to mine. So there was an increase when the price suddenly skyrocketed in the early 1980s. People were running around all over the place. One person came up on Portage Creek. It was Henry Gedney, actually. Gedney? Something like that. And I believe he's the one who brought up a cement mixer, the idea being to take the materials and mix them in the cement mixer to wash the clay off of them before they were put on a conveyor belt and brought up to the sluice box, which was a good idea, although from what I can gather, there was a little problem with it. Unfortunately, he ran into pay dirt that didn't have any clay on it. Okay, well, other people ran into pay dirt that had lots of clay on it, and they couldn't work it. But that showed up, and by...
Is it still there?
What?
Is it still there, the cement mixer?
I don't think so. Henry still has claims on Deadwood Creek down near 26 Pub. But...
Okay, so this is, you got us up through the 80s when there was an influx of people in the 80s when the price of gold went up. What is the price of gold currently?
Well, I haven't looked lately. I think it's about 1180, 80 something. It's higher than it's ever been before, but on the other hand, if you figure that it went up one day for a short instant to, I think, around $800 or $900 an ounce in 1980 or 81, and you figure in the inflation, it's not at an all-time high. But still, it's good enough. A lot of people are dancing up and down happily, and those who've been mining all these years at $300 an ounce gold are much happier mining at $1,200 an ounce gold.
So do you think that's going to feed into the future of the central community at all?
You know, that's really hard to tell. Basically because, well, now you've spread out. They mined the benches as far as it paid. All of a sudden, if you can have the price go up and yet not have the fuel go up so tremendously, then you have an area, you know, farther out from the original creek. You even have some of the tailing piles that might be worth reworking. So it may be that, and you might come up with new mining methods that enable you to get a higher recovery. One of the things you'll find now back, I believe Dale Apple's got one of these jig units and did quite well the first year, and I think from what I had heard, he kind of lost his shirt the second year on it. The sluice box, they were talking about this in one of the mining meetings in the 80s, and the average recovery on the sluice boxes was supposed to be about 30%. If you could get something that would recover another 30%, there's a lot of tailings out there that could be remined, or at one time could have been remined. The federal government has required that you level the tailings and hopefully plant daisies or whatever, or at least willows, on them. So it used to be that a lot of this stuff was stacked up and actually would be easy to rerun. When we had our mineral patent examination in 1981, they got a value on the tailings, and I think this is about $500 gold, of a dollar a yard. Now that's not real good, except for the fact that these were all in nice piles and could have easily been rerun through with very little, you know, no stripping or anything like that. So it might have been feasible, and at today's prices, who knows? So As it always is, mining is kind of a crapshoot for a lot of people. They go in, they move a lot of material. There was a guy, and his name was George, and I don't remember his last name. He came through in the 1980s, and he had bought some claims from Gene Darity. Darity had managed the hot springs in 1976. In fact, I was sitting there as I saw the hot springs backhoe go flying by, heading for Squaw Creek to do assessment work. And Darity guaranteed George that the ground was running $5 a yard, and there was only one little problem with the ground, and that it was not running gold at all. It was on the wrong side of Harrison Creek, being on the south side, away from the gold body and everything like that. The guy told us that he ran 50,000 yards and didn't get any gold. It's kind of hard to believe.
Some tall tales.
Some tall tales. Well, yeah, and then there was the day that the guy who had mining claims up near Livengood came in. This was, I think, 1983, and announced to a gal who was with a guy mining on one of our claims that he had just shot his boss. And, well, the guy, this is one of those situations where the guy had apparently discovered that he wasn't going to get paid. And this guy was marginal at best and quite upset about the thing. And he pointed the gun at the boss, and the boss grabbed the gun and pulled it down and caught a bullet in the groin. So there, you know, there's excitement like that that goes on all the time at mining claims. People do that, drop boulders on their thumbs. It's been an interesting 40 years, really.
That's why you joined the Central Rescue Team, so you could help rescue some of your mining partners, or mining folks.
These people, well, you know, you go in there, you go in with equipment. You either go in with equipment that's total junk and then spend most of your time repairing the equipment and little time mining, or you go in there with brand new equipment and don't find any gold. That's always a good one. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways to lose your shirt mining. And then there are people around here who have mined for 20, 30 years. You know, Fred Wilkinson, I believe, I don't think Fred has ever had a bad year. From what I've heard, he continually gets gold. He knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Dean Willis has been mining on Crooked Creek for quite a few years. He has a deposit that's not that rich, but it's like he knows if he mows so many yards, he's going to get so many dollars. Okay, and there are some others who have done this and are quite successful at mining.
One of the things I wanted to ask about was floods. Are there any old stories about floods that you know about?
Stories about floods. Well, it depends on the kind of floods. Yukon River regularly during breakup will do some flooding, and we've got some pictures. I think of 1948 seems to be one of the years. I think that's also the year we have pictures of water running past Central House. So there were floods there. I think you remember quite well June, I believe it was 29th, 1989. Okay. We had Dan put out a can, and in 40 hours we collected 4 inches of rain. This had a rather profound effect, and our little stream that normally was about 3, 4, 5 feet wide was suddenly 20 feet wide and quite deep, and everything was moving down it, mud, trees, whatever. That flooded the museum out. It put water all over in downtown Central. That was one of the worst. We had in 19, I believe it was 99, we had a thunderstorm that just sat above Half Dollar Creek and rained like mad, and we ran into our little shed that BLM was making us tear down, and waited out the storm. We came back, and all of a sudden the water began to rise, and the next thing you know, the water is about 4 or 5 feet deep and just washing everything. We had dragged a lot of the mining equipment up so that it didn't wash away, but a bunch of things washed away. And this was just a very short duration flash flood, but a tremendous amount of water moving down.
You also told me about a flood that flooded the area you had been mining one year.
That's
this one, and then it refilled the hole?
Oh, no. Yeah, that was last year, I believe. You came out, and you were, you and Wesley and a friend of Luke's, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And you came out, and you did some, shoveled about a yard, or half a yard through one day, and we were finishing up a hole, and the next day it rained, and the hole entirely refilled with gravel from upstream, and the gravel from upstream ran as well as the stuff I took out of the hole the first time. That was just a small high water.
Small high water. So it wasn't a flood.
It was probably as much water as we'd seen in 5 or 6 years. In 1975, we had dug a test hole off the bank, and we had just gotten down to bedrock. We were about 10.5 feet down, and we had stacked all of the material next to the creek, and the next day we were going to sluice, and unfortunately we had a heavy rain, and the creek came up quite high. It took all of the material that we were going to sluice and removed it, and we went up the next day and looked to nothing to sluice. So we went up to the hole, and there was 10.5 feet of water in the hole. So we couldn't even go down to the bedrock area and scrape around down there and get some material out to find out if there was anything down there.
When did you eventually find out?
We never did.
Oh.
It turned out that now the hole was thawed, it began to slump, and it was not necessarily a safe thing to go into.
Mm-hmm.
Old timers solved that problem by covering the holes, you know, so that the permafrost would not be destroyed, but
mm-hmm.
we lost that one. The interesting thing is you would have to, probably we should have just pumped it out. And you would have to, because if you let it set for the winter, then you'd have an ice core in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we've talked about how mining has really affected life here. How about the role of the church? Have you had anything to do with the role of the church in the
mm-hmm.
development of Central?
No, haven't had anything to do with that. I should say how mining has affected things. When we got into the 80s, I think you'll remember that Ella Hosmer, later Galvin,
mm-hmm.
Opened up a bakery at the Hot Springs, and Jim Ryder opened up a gift shop, and the Pearsons opened up a general store, and at that time, too, Bob LaRude was running the Hot Springs, and actually things were really going well there, part of it because they had a tremendous amount of business. There's a story about Bob LaRude. Bob was a good businessman, but he was also very good at pouring down the alcohol. And of course, he didn't mind drinking in his own bar because when he bought around, it really didn't cost him that much. And he had one really glorious night, and he hid the night's receipts, supposedly $5,000. In later years, that would be the month's receipts, and couldn't remember where, and apparently never did find it. So things were going good. It was supporting the bar at the Hot Springs. It was a bar at Central At the Central Lodge, Jim Crabb had opened up Crabb's Corner and fixed up an old place that had been there many years. I turned it into a nice place to have a meal and everything. We had three good places in town, which is three more than we have today. Mm-hmm. Bob LaRude, when he moved away from the Hot Springs, moved over and bought the home belonging to Ruth and Roy Olson and converted that into a little bar. And then the next year he made a big addition onto it, which is now the Central Motor Inn, which has been standing vacant for, almost 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
I think 8 years, maybe.
So he, this is when Bob LaRue was running the over there at the Hot Springs. And would you say that it was the mining activities itself that affected, you know, or was it the activity at the Hot Springs?
It was some of each. One thing I think that it was a nice place to come out to, and a lot of people came out from town. There were a lot of people and who were on the mining crews. And mining crews get paid, and when mining crews get paid, they come in to Ella's Bakery to buy donuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, okay, on their way to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, there's an interesting story that occurred. There was a guy, I won't mention his name, mainly because I've forgotten it. That's a good reason. But he was a great big guy, about 250 pounds, about 6'3", 6'4", maybe even 6'5". And he had had a lot to drink and was setting off fireworks. And Bob LaRude was in a bad mood. And he went out to show this guy that he couldn't do that. And I think he took a swing at the guy, and the guy took a swing at him. And Bob made the mistake of getting up. And the second time he didn't get up. And Bob Harrison came over just to try to make peace, and he got out of sock too, and he was smart enough not to get up. And it's just
So how did the guy simmer down? He just finally just set off the
fire? I think he just decided he lost interest in the whole thing, that there was really nobody to...
Okay. Well, I know that you are...
He was just having a good time, actually.
I know that you also worked at the Hot Springs. When did you work there?
I worked there from 11 o'clock, on July 3rd, 1991, until sometime, I think maybe about the 15th of September in 2002, when Bob and Laverna shut it down. I worked... about half the time for Susan Knappman and the other half of the time for Laverna Miller. Mm-hmm. Or at least her name was on the check. So I saw interesting things, some of which we don't mention. I remember one thing, we had a couple of cooks one time, and I think both of them were psychopaths, and they didn't get along. And one got mad one day and went down to an area in the ATCO units that they had been planning on renting out, but had never gotten around to it, and kicked down the door of the bathroom and kicked out all the fixtures to pieces. And everything like that, and Anyway, he had a party one night and got very sick, and he was due to cook breakfast and he didn't show up. And guess who got to cook breakfast?
It wasn't you, was it?
It was me.
Oh.
It was me.
And
I cooked for 25 people and 12 showed up.
And were the 12 people happy with their breakfast?
They were happy with the breakfast. I did scrambled eggs. I did bacon. I did anything that I knew how to do. You got some help. I think Linda Mason helped me with that one.
But most of the time you were not the cook?
With the exception of that time, I was never the cook.
What were you?
I was the night man. Okay. I'm the one who would sit there by the television set with my feet up and my mouth wide open, waiting for customers. and catch up. Lisa and Susan, I was the one who did the laundry at night.
Okay.